All right, good afternoon, everybody. This is Bow 241. It's May 6th. Indeed it is. And we're right in the middle of the respiratory chapter. And then we're going to move on to urinary chapter, and that's going to be the end of the class after urinary chapter. So the next test is going to be respiratory, urinary, and what's the one we did before this one? Oh, cardiac output and blood pressure and that one. All right, so those three chapters. All right, so all the PowerPoints are online, and I'll get the study guides up soon. You just have for blood pressure, which I think is chapter 14. Yeah, so we're going to do 14, 16, and 17. Those are the chapter numbers. All right, so last time we were talking about pulmonary function. We were talking about a couple different kinds of fluids. The pleural membrane is a serous membrane, and the middle layer of this pleural membrane contains fluid. The serous cavity contains serous fluid. And what kind of fluid is that? Is that a slippery fluid or a sticky fluid? Okay. Aha, I am glad I asked. That is the sticky fluid. Okay, the one between the lungs and the thoracic wall is the sticky fluid, so that when you expand your rib cage during inhalation, all right, that helps attach the thorax wall to the surface of the lungs, so it actually expands the lungs. That's one way that we inhale. The other way that we inhale is, of course, when you increase the volume of your thoracic cavity, what happens to pressure inside there?
It goes down.
It's inversely related. Pressure and volume are inversely related, and you should know that law. What law is that?
Boyle's law.
Right, okay. So it's just really easy to know if something's directly related, inversely related. It's real easy to figure those things out. All right, those two things. All right, the other fluid that we were talking about is actually inside the alveolus itself. All right, it's a water environment, and water by its nature is what? Is sticky. Water is sticky all by itself, and I'm glad I'm going to do a demonstration. I forgot to bring my materials last time. Water is sticky. That serous fluid in the pleural space is sticky. That's what attaches the wall of the thorax to the surface of the lungs. All right. But in the alveolus, since there's water in there, do we want the walls of the alveolus to be sticky?
No.
What is an alveolus? It should expand when we breathe, so air gets in there, so oxygen gets in there, so it can exchange with the capillaries. So an alveolus should expand. But if there's water in there, guess what? What's going to happen to the alveolus? It's going to stick together, right? So there's got to be a compound that defeats surface tension in the alveolus, and we did talk about that last time. So I'm sure you remember. It's called
surfactant,
right? And surfactant is like a soap or a detergent. And it defeats surface tension so that an alveolus can expand. All right, so since some of you don't really believe that water is sticky, let's just see. Here we have a couple transparencies, which is maybe kind of hard to see for you guys in the back. But can you see two transparencies right here? At least you can hear that there's two. All right, if I put them together and I just hold the top one and the bottom one is offset a little bit, but they're still touching each other. If I let go of the bottom one, what's going to happen to it? It's just going to fall right off because it's not glued together. What could we use as glue to glue these two pieces of?
Water.
Yeah, water. All right, so let's pretend this is an alveolus right here, and it's filled with plain old water, and maybe this is a premature baby, and the alveoli have water in it, and I say premature because they don't have surfactant. Oh, I need to just clean up just a little bit of a mess right here. Okay, don't have surfactant. And, all right, so now I'm holding the two transparencies together like this. All right, and now I'm going to let go of the bottom one, and what happens? They're stuck together because water is very sticky. Now, how sticky is that? Is that really sticky? Okay, as a matter of fact, I'm going to have you pull on the bottom sheet, okay, and I'm going to pull on the top one. Oh. I didn't lift you out of your chair. I was hoping I would actually lift you up. All right, it slid too easily for some reason. I'm not sure why. Let's try it again. Maybe I talked too long. It's a little bit tighter. But still, there's a lot of tension between these two sheets of paper. Okay? An alveolus would never expand if that surface tension wasn't defeated somehow. Okay, so the serous fluid has surface tension, so it couples the surface of the lungs to the wall of the thorax, but the alveolus, that surface tension is defeated by surface tension. That's real important. All right, we also talked about a couple different kinds of breathing. We talked about quiet breathing and forced breathing. last time. And what did we say? What do you need to inhale? Is it active or passive?
It's active.
It's active, so you need muscle contraction. What kind of muscles work for inspiration, for quiet breathing?
Diaphragm
primarily, maybe some external intercostals, right? Diaphragm decreases, right? Increases the thoracic volume. Pressure decreases because the volume is going up, right? They're inversely related. And the external intercostals lift the rib cage up and out laterally and also anteriorly up and out, decreasing the pressure so air flows in. Now, what about quiet expiration? What muscles are necessary for quiet expiration? Sorry about my cough. You don't need any, right? Because it is passive. What's producing expiration passively during quiet? Okay, pressure changes. All right, but not muscle. We're not changing. What's causing the change in volume? Relaxation of the diaphragm, and it's a skeletal muscle. All skeletal muscles have what kind of property?
Recoil
because of elasticity. All skeletal muscles have elasticity, so the diaphragm is going to go back into its dome-shaped configuration because of elasticity. Where else are there elastic proteins? Around each and every alveolus, right? So on inspiration, when you expand an alveolus, you stretch those elastic proteins, and then when the diaphragm relaxes, what do those elastic proteins do? They cause the recoil of an alveolus. All right, so I got a couple alveoli right here, right? Both of these I picked up last night on the way home. Okay, so here's a balloon, and here's just a paper bag. And so let's pretend that this paper bag is an alveolus, and when we inspire, what does an alveolus do? It inflates.
Yeah.
All right, so let's inflate this. And we said that for quiet breathing, then it should automatically deflate. So let's see if that happens. Do you think it will? Okay, so here's an alveolus, and I trapped all that air in there. See, did you see that it expanded? Absolutely. Okay, now I'll relax, and then I'll let the air escape. Is it going to escape? Okay, didn't escape. Does that look like a good model of a healthy alveolus?
No,
because that air would be trapped in there, and then if the air is trapped in there, you can't inhale, right? So you're going to be in respiratory distress. Now here's a balloon. Let me know which one is a better model, better way of thinking of a normal alveolus. So here's a balloon. Did you all see it expand? Absolutely, okay. And then don't forget, for quiet breathing, it's what? Just passive, right? Just passive. Oops, sorry. Sorry. All right, so I'm just going to let go, and what's going to happen to air inside this alveolus? Oh, no. No, you got glasses. Good. Okay. That's sort of what they do, but they don't make so much noise usually. Okay. So what's a better model? The balloon. Why? Because it has elastic, right? It has elastic properties. Okay, it has elastic properties. So don't forget, for quiet expiration, it's passive just because of elastic recoil. But for forced inspiration and expiration, and let's think about expiration, what muscles do you need for forced expiration? Any? Yes, you do need some muscles for forced expiration when you're hyperventilating, so you need abdominal muscles, rectus abdominis, transverse abdominis, internal, external, oblique. All right, so that helps with expiration for forced breathing. Okay, well, we eventually ended up talking about how oxygen is transported in the body by the circulatory system. Oxygen does not like to dissolve in fluids. Okay, doesn't like to dissolve in water. It really doesn't like to dissolve in blood by itself. And I think, maybe I did have a diagram of that. Oh, I didn't turn my cursor on. Come on, cursor. Cursor? Where's the cursor? Let's try this again. Okay. Let's plug and unplug the transmitter really quick. See what happens. It was working. Okay. Let me get it back. Okay. Right here. All right, so there was your hemoglobin molecule. All right, so without Hemoglobin in blood. What contains hemoglobin? Red blood cells, right? So here we have plasma without red blood cells, therefore no hemoglobin. So this plasma right here, if we just bubble oxygen through it at atmospheric pressure, will become completely saturated at a partial pressure of 100 millimeters of mercury, which if we were to measure the amount of the oxygen as a volume would be 0.3 mLs for 100 mLs of plasma. Right, so oxygen really does not like to dissolve in fluid, very limited amount. But if we have red blood cells loaded with hemoglobin, okay, every hemoglobin molecule can bind four, and I think there's almost 300 million hemoglobins per red blood cell. Does that say that on the slide? Oh, it does, pretty close. The concentration now goes up to 20 milliliters of oxygen per 100 mLs of blood. So that's how oxygen is transported, bound to hemoglobin within red blood cells. All right, so what is that a factor of? Well, let's pretend that's a 2. All right, so that would be a factor of 100. 100 times more oxygen can dissolve in or can be carried by the blood when there's hemoglobin in it because of the red blood cells. Yeah, question? No, okay. All right, so that's the job of hemoglobin. All right, so here we have a plot of how hemoglobin binds oxygen depending on the partial pressure of oxygen in its local environment. So we have the percent oxyhemoglobin. When hemoglobin binds oxygen, it's called oxyhemoglobin. Right, so this is percent oxyhemoglobin saturation. So 100% means what? The hemoglobin is completely bound to oxygen, and zero is there's absolutely no oxygen bound to hemoglobin whatsoever. Right, and we see that as the partial pressure of oxygen increases, what can you tell me about the binding of oxygen to hemoglobin? It goes up. Yeah, so it's directly related, but it's kind of one of these fancy little curves. It's not just a straight line. It's what we call this sigmoidal type curve. It looks kind of like an S. It's an S-shaped curve. All right, and oxygen concentration is different in different parts of your body. So we're going to plot the saturation of oxygen on hemoglobin versus the partial pressure of oxygen, right? And that's what the previous table was about, was all the individual data points that make up this curve. And the two points that we're interested in is what is the partial pressure of oxygen in an artery, like a systemic artery, and what's the partial pressure in a systemic vein? All right, and it is 100, right? And that's just, we can relate that to the previous example right here. Okay, when we're breathing normally, we have 100 millimeters of mercury, right, in the plasma, and you have 100 millimeters of mercury in plasma here as well. All right, so in arteries, there's 100 millimeters of mercury of oxygen. That's a partial pressure of oxygen. What can you tell me about the saturation of hemoglobin at that concentration of oxygen in blood? It's very high. You look up at the top of the curve and you can see that it is really 100% or very, very close to 100%, completely saturated. All right, so this blood is then going to travel to a capillary, okay? And in that capillary, exchange is going to take place. Oxygen concentration is going to decrease across that capillary because the tissue is going to absorb that oxygen and use it up. And by the distal end of the capillary, right at the vein, the partial pressure of oxygen in the blood has now dropped to 40 millimeters of mercury. So what does that say about the percent saturation of oxygen on hemoglobin then? Well, it's going to decrease because the partial pressure decreased, and it decreases to maybe what, about 75%, something of around that nature. So between this level here in the arteries and this level here in the veins, this is the amount of oxygen that's actually delivered to the tissues because there's a difference, there's a decrease in partial pressure of oxygen between arteries and veins. Or between, you could even think of this as an alveolus, the capillaries in the lung, compared to capillaries in your systemic tissues. Okay, so that's how much oxygen can be delivered. So this is just a typical oxygen binding curve. Okay. So let's look at this graph right here. So you were probably wondering, well, if oxygen binds to hemoglobin, how come, let's go back to the slide, how come oxygen is released from hemoglobin in the tissues? It's released from hemoglobin because the tissues use up oxygen and there's a lower partial pressure of oxygen in the blood in the systemic capillaries. And you could think of that as being like La Chatelier's principle, right? As you use up oxygen, then oxygen comes unbound from hemoglobin and it's then absorbed by the tissues. And here's a nice curve that shows that. Okay. Well, here we see a couple oxygen binding curves as a function of pH, and you can see it shifting around. And usually we call it a right shift or a left shift, and that's really what I want you to appreciate. So here it is, pretty much 7.4. This is a pH of normal blood. Okay. And then guess what happens to blood pH, for instance, when you start to exercise? What happens to the pH of blood?
Okay.
It goes down, becomes a little bit more acidic because maybe the lactic acid is being put into blood and other kinds of metabolites. CO2 goes up, that changes the pH of blood as well. Remember, because of what enzyme is involved in interconverting CO2 and carbonic acid? Carbonic anhydrase, right? So the pH of blood goes down. So what does that mean to oxygen delivery to tissues when they become highly metabolic? Do you think that hemoglobin should deliver more oxygen when a tissue is metabolic or less oxygen? What would make sense? Probably more. And let's take a look and see if indeed hemoglobin will do that for us. So this first curve right here shows under normal conditions, not exercise, for instance, right? And in the arterial blood, remember we have about 100 millimeters of mercury, right? So both hemoglobins at both pHs are going to be essentially 100% saturated with oxygen. And now let's follow this other curve for the lower pH, which might simulate exercise. And where is it at 40 millimeters of mercury? Okay, this is the partial pressure of oxygen that we find at the distal end of a capillary or right at a vein. So let's follow that up, all right? And can you see that there is a huge difference in the release of oxygen to the tissues? Right, the difference is what? From about 75 all the way down to 60. It almost doubles as a result of that change in pH. So more oxygen can be delivered to the tissue exactly when it needs to have that additional oxygen when it is when that muscle is exercising. So do we call this a right shift or a left shift as the pH decreases? It's a right shift. Right? So when you think of a right shift, that means that hemoglobin can deliver more oxygen to the tissues when there's a right shift.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So the one with 7.20 is just a right shifted one?
Yeah. Because here's 7.4 right in the middle. That's a normal blood pH.
So that's a higher, that's more acidic.
It's more acidic, absolutely.
And that means that there's more oxygen being delivered?
More oxygen being delivered because this oxygen binding curve shifts to the right. All right, so if there's ever a circumstance where you see an oxygen binding curve shifting to the right, that means more oxygen is being delivered to the tissues. And you could prove that to yourself by looking at the axes of this graph right here. Okay?
Can I ask a question
about the two? Yeah. This one right here.
No, it was the one, the other graph.
Okay, yeah.
The disassociation of
oxygen to hemoglobin.
Yeah, is due to pressure, you
said? Is due to the partial pressure of oxygen.
Getting yeah.
Well, anywhere. The binding of oxygen to hemoglobin is driven by relatively high partial pressure of oxygen in the lungs by the alveoli, and then unloading is driven by relatively lower partial pressure of oxygen in the tissues because tissues are using oxygen up. All right, so I maybe think of it as like Le Chatelier's principle again. Okay, so if you use a metabolite up, the reaction goes reverse, and okay, it just maintains the equilibrium. Okay? All right, so this is the amount of oxygen that gets unloaded in the tissues as you go from 100 millimeters of mercury down to 40. All right, and what this curve shows you, as you go from 100 millimeters of mercury to 40, all right, you get an additional release of oxygen from hemoglobin because the oxygen binding curve for a lower pH is shifted to the
right.
Shifted to the right. Okay. If it shifts to the left, then hemoglobin is releasing less oxygen. That's not helpful to us. All right. Let's look at a couple other circumstances. But just Okay, trust me, right shift is good because it's delivering what? More oxygen to the tissues. Okay. All right, there's another compound that helps, that can shift that pH, or can shift the oxygen binding curve, and that is 2,3-diphosphoglycerate. And this is a compound that's involved with glycolysis. Okay. And when there is low oxygen partial pressures, for instance, at high altitude, right, when we go up in the mountains, there's less oxygen, right? And so the partial pressure decreases. So what does that mean in terms of binding hemoglobin? So instead of saying 100 millimeters of mercury, maybe it's 80, right? So there's less oxygen bound to hemoglobin because you're up at altitude. So you have less oxygen carrying capacity of the blood. All right, and 2,3-DPG is inhibited by high oxygen concentration. So as there's less oxyhemoglobin, there's less inhibition of 2,3-DPG. All right, so more 2,3-DPG is produced, and that produces, and I don't have a picture for you, but that produces a right shift in the oxygen binding curve for oxygen and hemoglobin. So if the curve shifts to the right, what does that mean? There's a lower affinity of oxygen for hemoglobin, so that just delivers more oxygen to the tissues as a result of that little metabolite right there, 2,3-DPG. So it's almost just like a decrease in pH. So an increase in 2,3-DPG acts just like a decrease in pH, and it delivers more oxygen to the tissues. So what's the effect? That increases oxygen unloading in the tissues, and that subtracts from the stimulus, which is what? A less O2 delivery to the tissue. So this is a nice negative feedback mechanism that helps oxygen delivery to the tissues. And this works really nice because one of the things that you can't get away with, here we have red blood cells filled with hemoglobin. Say you start to live in the mountains and you have a normal hematocrit maybe of 45 and you want to compensate for decreased oxygen carrying capacity of blood, can you boost your red blood cells from a hematocrit of 45 to say 60% or 70%? What happens then? You have more red blood cells, you can carry more oxygen, but what happens to the blood? It sludges up. Which means what? The viscosity changes. What happens to resistance to flow when viscosity goes way up? Resistance goes way up, blood flow goes way down, so that's not helpful. So here's a way you can boost oxygen carrying capacity of the blood without affecting viscosity. So that's pretty handy.
So is it like a right
shift? So it's a right shift, exactly. So in your book, that right shift is not in there, so you might want to pencil that in. Okay, underneath lower affinity for hemoglobin for oxygen. Okay.
So you can tell if there's more oxygen being delivered to tissues because the percent of oxyhemoglobin goes down.
Yes.
Because it's being disassociated from the hemoglobin.
Exactly right. Yeah.
That's why.
And that curve is shifted to the right.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. All right, so there's one more condition too that I want you to show. I want to show you. And most textbooks have all three of these curves. I guess I don't have it here, but I have this table. All right, so we talked about a decrease in pH shifts the curve to the right. That means there's more oxygen unloading in the tissues. We talked about an increase in 2,3-DPG. That shifts the oxygen binding curve to the right, delivering more oxygen to the tissues. But it's also temperature dependent. All right, so it's dependent on a number of variables, like maybe you would guess. When there's an increase in temperature, under what kind of conditions might a muscle temperature increase?
Exercise.
During exercise, for instance. Exactly right, because what do you do when you start exercising? What do you do when you start thinking of exercising? You start sweating, okay? Okay, so muscle temperature increases, and guess what that does to the binding curve? It shifts it to the right, and so what does that do to oxygen unloading in the tissues when the oxygen binding curve is shifted to the right? It helps unloading, right? So a decrease in pH, an increase in 2,3-DPG, or an increase in temperature aids oxygen unloading to tissues. So hemoglobin is kind of a handy molecule to have, right? So not only does it increase the oxygen carrying capacity of the blood 100-fold or so, but it operates in the right way that our normal physiology operates. It can deliver more oxygen when the tissues need more oxygen. So that's pretty handy. All right, so that's the important thing about that dissociation curve. All right, here, I'm not going to talk much about this, but here we have some normal red blood cells. Can you see these? You can? Okay, from my angle, I can't hardly see them. Well, probably because they're red. Okay, so here we have some normal red blood cells, and you can see they're nice and smooth and round with a little dimple on the inside. These over here are from somebody that has sickle cell disease. And when somebody has sickle cell disease, they have inherited a mutation in the gene that produces hemoglobin, and it is a change in just one base, just one base in the whole gene that codes for hemoglobin. And so when oxygen concentration decreases in somebody with that inherited disease, the hemoglobin changes conformation. It doesn't like to carry oxygen, but it also changes the shape of a red blood cell. And it looks kind of sickle. It has all these pointed and sharp ends on it. And these kinds of cells have trouble flowing through very small vessels. They get stuck. They don't flow in a nice laminar form. And so these cells don't deliver oxygen to tissues. They get stuck. They occlude blood flow. And I think we talked about this. What happens to a muscle, for instance, when and you're using it and it's not getting oxygen? What does it feel like?
Oh, it's
got hurts like what? Hurts like hell. Okay, so that's really unfortunate disease to have. And of course, don't forget, we can treat these people with hydration therapy, but they need red blood cells, and of course, they also need opiates because they hurt like they have that muscle cramp where? All over their body. All right, but also in their kidneys, their brain, their heart. You don't have pain receptors in those organs, but they're being damaged as well. No, just a portion of them. And depending on the exact mode of inheritance, sometimes they just have a mixing of normal and abnormal. And if they have a mixing of abnormal and normal, they probably don't go into crisis. But if they got two genes for this sickling trait, then they can go into a full-blown crisis mode under low oxygen tension, because you see how oxygen, depending on the partial pressure of oxygen, will bind more or less oxygen. Okay, so periods of exercise, periods of dehydration and exercise are really bad. Yeah.
I hear that people with heterozygous sickle cell are immune to malaria.
Now, yeah, some people might be wondering, well, why, since this produces a really kind of deadly disease, why on earth are people still being born with it? Why has the human population evolved to have that particular trait? And the reason is for the thing that you mentioned, and that is malaria. Probably might produce more disease than almost any other kind of organism on the planet. Okay, and so it's a disease where your blood hemolyzes, it bursts open, and people with that mutation in their hemoglobin are protected from malaria. All right, so for that reason it was selected out in the population, because if you only get half the gene, not two genes, because we didn't talk about much in terms of genetics, but you have a set of genes from your mom, a set of genes from your dad, right? So if you just get one set from your mom that has a sickling trait, that protects you from malaria, and you don't have sickle cell crisis quite so bad. Okay, so that's why people still have that. Oh, yeah. Well, sure, because when these cells sickle, they don't go back to their normal shape. They hemolyze. And that releases all those millions and millions of hemoglobin molecules that have an iron molecule in it. And so these folks have a tendency to build up iron in their tissues because it's being released so often. All right, so a normal person has to make between 2 and 3 million red blood cells every second. Somebody that has this disease, I don't even know how many million more they have to make. Okay, so they have much more trouble dealing with iron overload than most of us. Okay, and yeah, that might influence other kinds of clinical tests that you might perform on them when they have that iron overload. Like, it's probably harder to do an MRI exam because it's a metal, and metals disrupt MRI exams. So you might not be able to image some of their organs quite as well. All right, so that's oxygen transport. What do you need for oxygen transport?
Hemoglobin
with? Yeah, in red blood cells, but that hemoglobin has to have that iron molecule in it, right? It's got to have that iron molecule. Okay, carbon dioxide. Let's talk about carbon dioxide. That's the other important kind of gas to be transported. Carbon dioxide kind of loves to dissolve into fluid, right? It has no problem. As a matter of fact, you're aware of that because how would you know that carbon dioxide has no problem dissolving in fluid as opposed to oxygen? Like, for instance, like soda pop is loaded with carbon dioxide, champagne, things like that. So if you shake those things, you can actually get all that carbon dioxide to just explode out of the fluid. All right, so you don't need hemoglobin to carry carbon dioxide like you do oxygen. All right, so here you have tissues making carbon dioxide, dissolves into plasma, no problem whatsoever. And 10% of it, right, 10% of the carbon dioxide that's produced is just dissolved as a solute in plasma, and it can be carried. Right? For oxygen, it's almost zero. None can be carried. All right, so that's pretty good. So, but there's got to be a better way. Some then continue to diffuse right through the plasma membrane of the red blood cell because CO2 is the sort of a hydrophobic kind of compound. It can dissolve through lipid membranes. And so it dissolves into this red blood cell, and some of it combines with hemoglobin. 20% can combine with hemoglobin and is transported that way. All right, so now we're up to 30%. How is the remainder, and this is the majority of carbon dioxide? Well, when you have carbon dioxide in water, what can you make?
Carbonic
acid, and blood is loaded with an enzyme that speeds this reaction up, namely carbonic anhydrase. Yeah, carbonic anhydrase. Okay, and then this dissociates very rapidly into bicarbonate and hydrogen ions, and these hydrogen ions right here can combine with hemoglobin or be buffered by other kinds of buffers inside the cell. And this bicarbonate ion is pretty much like salt. So if you take some salt out of a salt shaker and put it in a glass of water, how much dissolves into it? Almost all of it. Yeah, you can put a ton of salt into water. Same thing for bicarbonate. Bicarbonate basically is baking soda. You could probably take a box of baking soda and get the whole box to dissolve in just a cup of water, right? So bicarbonate is the way that most of the carbon dioxide that these tissues produce is transported in the blood as the bicarbonate ion. All right, now why are these cells producing CO2 again?
Because they're using up
oxygen. What's the metabolic pathway that's producing CO2? Okay, not electron transport, but we're close. At least we're in cellular respiration. It's a Krebs cycle. That's right, Krebs cycle. All right, don't forget any of that stuff. Especially if you take Professor Landis's biochemistry class. Okay, you'll be really excited you know this stuff. Okay, all right. Well, you have bicarbonate, which is an anion, right? It's a monovalent anion. In order to maintain the electrical neutrality of the cell, as bicarbonate leaves, chloride, which is a monovalent anion, enters the cell. As a result, we call that a chloride shift. So that's a little mechanism that's necessary to transport bicarbonate in the blood. So hemoglobin is not necessarily necessary. All right, now how do we get rid of carbon dioxide from our bodies once we get to the lung? Okay, bicarbonate gets to the lung in the blood. What happens? It goes back because, remember, the free energy change is almost nil. So carbonic anhydrase then works the reaction in the other way. So bicarbonate then can enter the cell. Well, let's start up over here. So you have some carbon dioxide that's dissolved in plasma, moves down its concentration gradient. Remember, it's almost zero in air. All right. And as the concentration of CO2 decreases in plasma, what happens? Again, you can use Le Chatelier's principle to say, well, what happens then to hemoglobin that's bound to carbon dioxide? Then it's going to dissociate, and carbon dioxide is going to dissolve into the plasma, replacing the one that was in the plasma that diffused into the alveolus. All right, so that unloads carbon dioxide from hemoglobin. Oh, carbaminohemoglobin is the proper term for when hemoglobin binds carbon dioxide, as opposed to what, oxyhemoglobin, when it binds oxygen. All right, so, and then that carbon dioxide diffuses out of plasma. Well, when that carbon dioxide diffuses out of plasma, then bicarbonate enters this red blood cell, combines with hydrogen ions to form carbonic acid, and then carbonic acid, because of carbonic anhydrase, gets converted into CO2, and then that runs down its concentration gradient into the alveolus, and you expel it out of your lungs. All right, so this is a reversible reaction, and that's how we get rid of carbon dioxide, okay, from our lungs.
Is that why we're not like a respiratory outfit, which you could find cars down here, just having
when you have acidosis, yeah? Okay, so yeah, so bicarbonate is a really good basic, and actually it acts as a buffer, and it eats up those hydrogen ions.
It acts as an inner.
I'm sorry?
It doesn't in the erythrocyte.
That's probably where the majority of carbonic anhydrase is. It's inside of cells, and if you ever damage a cell, it gets released. Okay, but if it's a normal cell, it'll be on the inside. I had an interesting thing to say, but I forgot what it was. It had to do with your question. Oh, and that is, you said something about a respiratory acidosis, okay? But what I was thinking of immediately when you said respiratory was respiratory alkalosis, okay? What is a respiratory alkalosis, and can you see with this mechanism right here? So think of somebody that's hyperventilating. So somebody's breathing very deeply and rapidly. What happens to CO2 in this alveolus when somebody's breathing rapidly? It rapidly leaves their body, right? So you're excreting a lot of CO2. So what happens to Le Chatelier's principle right here? Is it impeded or is it accelerated? Okay, as we decrease the concentration here, does CO2 have more of a tendency to leave the blood or less tendency to leave the blood as we decrease concentration?
Less.
If we decrease the concentration here in the alveolus, that actually increases the concentration gradient, right? It still is relatively high in the blood and low here, really low in the alveolus. That increases the gradient, which means what? Diffusion is faster, right? So that pulls more CO2 out of the blood. And as you pull more CO2 out of red blood cells, what happens to this reaction right here? It gets driven to the left to make even more CO2. And how do you make CO2? You take bicarbonate and hydrogen ion. So hydrogen ion is the basis of acidity in this cell. So now you're using up the acidity of this red blood cell right here to get rid of carbon dioxide. And that's when somebody becomes alkalotic, because you're using up this hydrogen ion when they are hyperventilating. And so that's what we call a respiratory alkalosis. Yeah. That will increase blood pH. Yeah. That will increase blood pH. And that's an interesting thing. Rent Andromeda strain. And that's an interesting mechanism that's used to explain an interesting feature of Andromeda strain.
Well, what really causes that in the clinical setting, besides the
hyperventilating patient? I don't know. Anxiety. Okay. Anxiety attacks. Yeah. Disrupts pH. If somebody is in a metabolic acidosis, okay, that will stimulate respiration, and that is one way people can excrete hydrogen ions. So when somebody's in an acidosis, they probably will have a higher respiratory rate trying to get rid of those hydrogen ions, because it's going to be used to make carbon dioxide, and you just excrete carbon dioxide from your body. So you could actually think of carbon dioxide as being an acid. And so every time we breathe, what are we really breathing out of our body? Acid, yeah. We're like aliens, really. Okay, like when you ever see aliens, when there's some alien blood on the spacecraft, it just dissolves away. Where our respiratory gases, not quite that bad, but almost, not really almost, but very acidic. Our respiratory gases are highly acidic because of that.
So you can change, you can fix alkalosis.
For instance, one thing that you could do, for instance, yeah, I think that's one way that we treat anxiety attacks, is have people breathe into a paper bag, okay, and that increases their carbon dioxide concentration, and that helps reduce that changes the pH of our system and our brain, and that has a tendency to reduce anxiety, which then reduces that urgency to hyperventilate, okay. I don't think we use it clinically. Other than that, your body uses it in its physiology if you become acidotic, but we don't really use it clinically. It would be better to use bicarbonate, for instance.
Some sort of
ventilator.
Okay. If they're on a ventilator, you mean? Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, we can control
that. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's really some nice tricky stuff. All right, so that's our respiratory chapter. And we did some demonstrations in class. And I'll get the study materials for that soon. Okay. And so what do I have here? I didn't load it. Okay. Well, let's go to urinary system. Okay, so here's our last chapter. Okay, urinary system. Okay, nice simple system. So we're going to look at the structure and function of the kidney a little bit, but I think you remember all this stuff from anatomy. But if you don't, then probably in short order, you'll probably review stuff and relearn it. We're going to talk about glomerular filtration, reabsorption. We're going to talk about secretion, plasma clearance, and in some circumstances, how we control the electrolyte and acid-base balance via the kidneys. Okay, so functions of the kidney. This might be missing a couple things. Maybe I'll add some things. Is to regulate plasma and interstitial fluid by formation of urine. All right, and in the process of urine formation, the kidneys regulate the volume of blood plasma. Okay. Which does what? Contributes to blood pressure because it affects venous return. And it just, if you put the volume into a container, the pressure goes up. If you take volume out, the pressure goes down. All right. The kidney also filters waste products out of plasma, puts it in urine for excretion. It adjusts the concentration of electrolytes, including sodium and potassium and bicarbonate and other kinds of ions in the blood. And, of course, it helps adjust the plasma pH. It can adjust pH. It can secrete hydrogen ions into the filtrate, or it can reduce the secretion of hydrogen ions into filtrate that becomes urine. So what else does a kidney do from this class? What else? That's not on this list. That probably should be on this list. It secretes a hormone. Okay, that's an enzyme. It secretes renin, which adjusts blood volume. Okay. Angiotensin II. Renin acts on angiotensinogen to make angiotensin 1, and then ACE converts angiotensin 1 into 2, so that's not really what I'm thinking about. But a true hormone. It secretes a true hormone. Okay. Aldosterone comes from the adrenal cortex. Adrenal cortex, but it secretes erythropoietin. And what does erythropoietin do? It controls red blood cell production. Okay, so that's another important function of the kidney. Okay, so I know a lot of times in traditional Western medicine, we like to think that the muscles are for contraction and kidneys make urine, but you know what? Your body all functions together in all kinds of myriad ways, and I agree, it's hard to remember all the ways that different organs do different things, right? Okay, so that should be on your list too. So here is the structure of the urinary system. Well, what do you got? The main organs are the kidneys right here. They produce urine, and then it flows down through these ureters into the urinary bladder, and there urine is stored until proper time for voiding, and then urine leaves the bladder via the urethra to the outside world. Okay. Okay, so if we look at a cross-section of the kidneys, remember that the superficial layer is the cortex, the deep layer is the medulla, and the deeper layers or the medulla contain these pyramids, which is a collection of these tubular elements of a kidney. Right? So these are all parts of a nephron. It's not a whole nephron, but it's a part of a nephron. Some parts of the nephron, namely Bowman's capsule right here, is in the cortex, but the loop of Henle and most of the collecting ducts are in the medulla, and you can see all these collecting ducts coalescing at the tip of a pyramid, and that's what gives pyramids their particular kind of shape. So the fluid that's being excreted from collecting ducts is really urine, and then this ends up in this big collecting basin right here. This is what we call a minor calyx, right at the tip of a renal pyramid. So here we see two pyramids, here and here, and both of these are minor calyces, and when minor calyces join together, that forms what we call a major calyx, and then a number of major calyces will join together, anastomose, to form the renal pelvis right here, that funnel-shaped device that helps funnel urine into the ureter down to the urinary bladder. Okay. All right, so here is the tubular elements of a nephron. Here we have Bowman's capsule. Sometimes it's called the glomerular capsule, proximal convoluted tubule. Why do we call this a convoluted tubule? It's all twisted up. Hard to follow. Like what? Like physiology. I was going to pick on a politician, like a political argument for or against something, right? Hard to follow. But, okay, I can let you get away with physiology. Okay. And then, so the fluid in this tubule right here, the proximal convoluted tubule, that's not urine. That is what we call filtrate, and that's derived from blood plasma. And that filtrate makes its way through the descending and ascending loop of Henle and then into another convoluted tubule that's farther away from Bowman's capsule. So that's the distal convoluted tubule, finally entering the collecting duct. And when it's in the collecting duct, then it actually becomes urine. It can be processed a little more, right? But then that's really a product of this tubular system right here. Here is just a nice x-ray of, with contrast of fluid from the kidney. And here you can see a minor calyx and a major calyx and then the renal pelvis, a nice ureter and urinary bladder right here. So that's just some anatomy for you. The micturition reflex, the urination reflex, right? The bladder has smooth muscle wall. It's called the detrusor muscle, right? So that's smooth muscle. It's spontaneously active. Right, some smooth muscle can be spontaneously active, and it becomes more spontaneous as it stretches. So stretch acts as a stimulus. That causes spontaneous action potentials and then contraction or spasm of the urinary bladder. It's also innervated and controlled by the parasympathetic nervous system. That's sympathetic, but parasympathetic is stimulatory on the urinary bladder. So some drugs that treat overactive bladders or bladders in spasm target muscarinic acetylcholine receptors. So they're acetylcholine receptor blockers. Okay, so how does it work? Well, action potentials, you're going to have to remember a little anatomy. I don't have pictures of these things, but actions of the internal and external urethral sphincters are regulated by a reflex center located in the spinal cord. So you shouldn't be so surprised that there's a reflex center in the spinal cord. Filling of the bladder activates stretch receptors that send action potentials to the spinal cord and to, in particular, the micturition reflex center. That activates the parasympathetic neurons, causing contraction of the detrusor muscles. And when they contract, that causes relaxation of the internal urethral sphincter. That's the involuntary sphincter, right? So now then there is pressure up against the external urethral sphincter, and that gives you a sense of urgency, a sense that you have to void. Okay, and that's what you have voluntary control over. All right, when urination is consciously initiated, the descending motor tracts to the micturition center from your brain, okay, inhibit the somatic motor fibers of the external urethral sphincter, and as that voluntary muscle relaxes, then voiding occurs. Okay. So that's just a nice, simple micturition reflex. All right, so here's a question before we get to urine formation right here. What is, let me start with some other questions. What's the structural and functional unit of life?
A cell,
okay. What's the structural and functional unit of muscle contraction?
A sarcomere.
What's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells?
Synapse.
It was close, a synapse, right? So it's always really, I think, important to know structural and functional unit of something. And so here's a question. What is the structural and functional unit of urine formation? And you know what? We just talked about it a little bit, but I didn't define it for you. It is the nephron. Okay, so we got to understand how the kidney function. The only thing we really got to understand is how the nephron works. Okay, and one of the first things about understanding how the nephron works is to know something about the structure. Okay. We have about a million nephrons per kidney. It consists of very small tubules that we see right here. We went over the tubules. But it also has a vascular supply that we're going to go over in just a second. So that's the structural part of the nephron. And because of the interaction, because of the tubular elements as well as the vascular elements of a nephron, it can perform three functions. first function is glomerular filtration. That happens in Bowman's capsule. Then there could be tubular reabsorption. And the third function is tubular secretion. And I'll describe some of these. All right. And after these three processes are taking place, then the fluid that enters Bowman's capsule becomes urine as a result of that. So only these three processes. Okay. Okay, so make sure you review your vascular anatomy of the kidney. So what artery goes to a kidney? Yes, renal artery. Very good. Okay. And then once inside the kidney, it bifurcates. What's that first branch called? It's the segmental artery, right? And then the segmental arteries bifurcate as it goes between the pyramids. We call those the renal columns or the sections between the pyramids. What's that artery between the pyramids? That's called the interlobar artery. Okay, then it's at the base of the pyramid. It's now in the cortex. And then you see like those little arcing arteries. That's the arcuate. All right, and then from the arcuate arteries, there's some branches that poke up into the cortex. And those have now two different names depending on how old you are. They used to be called the interlobular arteries, but now they're just called the cortical radiate arteries. All right, and those are the arteries that feed the nephron. All right, so that's where we're really going to start our discussion, because the artery that feeds the nephron is the afferent arteriole. Okay, that supplies blood to the glomerulus. All right, so the way I want you to think about a nephron is, let's break it down in its two basic components. The tubular elements that don't contain blood, they contain either filtrate or urine. Alright, so these, Bowman's capsule, then proximal convoluted tubule, descending, ascending loop of Henle, distal convoluted tubule, collecting duct. Those are the tubular elements of the nephron. Don't contain blood. They contain filtrate or collecting duct, then it would be called urine. Okay. The other elements are the vascular elements associated with the nephron. And blood flows in to the nephron via the afferent arteriole. And remember, that's what the cortical radiate artery feeds, the afferent arteriole. And afferent arteriole feeds the glomerulus. And that is a special kind of capillary. What can you tell me about that kind of capillary? It's fenestrated. What does that mean, though? It's very leaky. It has holes in it. It has fenestrations in it, right? So it's a very leaky kind of capillary. So a lot of fluid in blood can leak out this kind of capillary. All right, and then the remainder of the blood that doesn't leak out flows into an efferent arteriole, and then it flows into another capillary system around the various tubes of the nephron. So we call these the peritubular capillaries. All right, so this is an interesting system because it's a big deviation compared to a normal systemic circulation, because how many capillary beds does a normal circulatory system have? Just one. And how many does this one have? It's got two. So this is really, what kind of system? This really is what kind of system is this? It's a portal system, right? A portal system has two capillary beds back to back with a portal vessel in between. And the portal vessel in this case would be the efferent arteriole. And then after the peritubular capillaries, blood flows into renal venule and then back into what, the cortical radiate vein, and then into the arcuate vein, and then the names of the veins are exactly the same as the arteries in the kidney. So that makes it really easy. All right, so make sure you can break that nephron down into those pieces. So here is a really nice picture of a nephron. Now, in this particular case, I wish our anatomy books had a nice picture like this. The pictures in anatomy are really complicated, but this is a nice, simple illustration. Right, so here you can see the arcuate artery and the cortical radiate, and then here is the afferent arteriole feeding the first capillary bed. That first capillary bed is the... you're shy, say it. Maybe you never pronounced it out loud. What is that? Glomerulus. That's the glomerulus right there. That's the leaky capillary. And the blood, the remaining, that doesn't get filtered out, the remaining blood flows through the efferent arteriole, and then this is the second capillary bed, the peritubular capillaries, and then that flows into this renal venial, and then into the vein, cortical radiate vein right here. All right, so what did we just describe? What kind of elements? Vascular elements, because it contains blood. Okay, now let's consider the tubular elements. The first part of the tubular system of the nephron is Bowman's capsule, And this is what's going to capture filtrate from the glomerulus. The fluid leaking out of the glomerulus ends up in Bowman's capsule. And then it's going to make its way through the PCT, which is proximal convoluted tubule, then down the descending loop of Henle, ascending loop of Henle, and then the DCT, and finally into the collecting duct over here. All right, so there are two different kinds of nephrons in our kidney. There are some that are mostly located in the cortex, and you know what? I guess I can almost perceive where the cortex is on this diagram. See where the cursor is right here? I never noticed that before, but that's probably a line that distinguishes the cortex from the renal medulla. And this nephron is mostly located in the cortex, so I would say this would be a cortical nephron. There are other nephrons that are located more down in the medulla, especially the loop of Henle descends very deep down into the medulla of the kidney. And that kind of nephron has an additional function. That kind of nephron can make urine concentrated. That means it can help the body retain water and excrete salt. And that kind of nephron is what we call a juxtamedullary nephron. Thank you. Juxtamedullary nephron. Okay, so that has a special function compared to this cortical nephron right here. All right, so you might always want to review that one. All right, so here you can see where the cortex is and where the medulla is, and we just talked about all this stuff already. Okay. All right, so Bowman's capsule. I like that term more than glomerular capsule. Oh, here is the juxtamedullary nephron right here. Here's a typical cortical nephron. This one is for concentrating urine, specifically for concentrating urine. All right, and if we have Bowman's capsule with the glomerulus inside of it as a unit, that's what we call a renal corpuscle. All right, so a renal corpuscle is both of those things put together. So we've got to be, yeah. That's okay.
You said the juxtamedullary nephron also is for pre-sodium
inclusion? Yeah. Concentrating urine, putting a lot of solutes, and sodium would be a prime example of a solute. Yeah. That's okay. Okay. The walls of the proximal convoluted tubule consist of just a single layer of cuboidal cells with millions of microvilli. What's the function of a microvilli? Okay, that's a cilia, but a microvilli increases the apical surface area of that cell, all right, which means it increases the doorway of that cell, so it increases absorption, all right. So that increases the surface area for reabsorption. During reabsorption, salt, water, and other molecules needed by the body are transported from the lumen of Bowman's capsule through those tubular cells and into the peritubular capillaries. Okay. I guess I don't really need to talk about that one anymore. All right, so we're thinking about the three processes that produce urine in the nephron. The first one is filtration, the second one is reabsorption, and the third one is secretion. All right, so let's talk about glomerular filtration first. All right, the capillaries filter blood. They're fenestrated. They have large pores between the endothelial cells, which are big enough to allow many plasma molecules to pass through. So they're not big enough for cells to pass through, like red blood cells or white blood cells. They're not big enough to allow large proteins through. Maybe some small proteins can get through. And since they're fenestrated, they're hundreds of times more permeable than the normal continuous capillaries in your body. All right, so small molecules like sodium can pass right through the fenestrations. Another small molecule would be glucose, can pass right through the fenestration. So here you can see the fenestrations in the endothelium of the capillary, right? So here is the lumen of the capillary. And then there's a small basement membrane, and attached to the basement membrane is a part of the glomerular capsule. So I tell you what, let's look back up at this part right here. Here is the external wall of Bowman's capsule, and we call this the parietal layer, and it is continuous. It doesn't necessarily show it on this diagram, but it's continuous with this layer that's right on top of the glomerular capillaries. All right, so Can you picture this as like being a serous membrane where this is the parietal division that is lining maybe the thoracic wall, and then as it moves over to the lungs, it then lies right on the surface of the lung, and that would be the visceral pleura, right? So use that same model in your mind to appreciate that this is the parietal wall of the glomerular capsule or Bowman's capsule, and this is the visceral division that sits right on top of those fenestrated capillaries. Well, if this visceral division was very tight and continuous, then fluid couldn't leak out of the capillaries, even if the capillaries were fenestrated. So these cells have been modified compared to the parietal division. They have a lot of space between the cells and between the different processes of the cell, and we call these filtration slits. So fluid can not only leak out of the capillary, but it can pass right through this division of the glomerular wall right into this space right here. So this would be like the serous cavity, right, that you might be familiar with in terms of the pericardial cavity or peritoneal cavity or pleural cavity. All right, so this material that leaks out of the capillary is filtrate, and it contains all the small molecules, including water, that we find in blood, good things and bad things. These things are what we call the podocytes this is a podocyte, and these are the foot processes, and you can see the filtration slits between the foot processes. So filtrate is very much like plasma. It has compounds in it that you don't want, like urea, for instance, which is toxic. It has compounds in it like glucose. And what can you tell me about glucose? Because glucose is a small molecule, water soluble. It goes right through, but is glucose a molecule that you want to throw away?
No.
Absolutely not. But if it's in the filtrate right here, what's going to happen to it? It's going to end up in, it's going to go through the tubular system, and it's going to end up in urine, and you'll void it from your body. And of course, you know that glucose is an important energy molecule. You should think of that process, if it ends up in urine, as the following. Suppose maybe you're low on gasoline in your car, and you want to drive home, so you're going to stop at the gas station on the way home and fill up your tank with gas. Hopefully it's not $5 a gallon tonight, but it was not too long ago. But think that it is what? It's a valuable commodity. Fill up your gas tank, and then if you're going to be losing glucose in the urine, what would that be like with your gas tank? That would be like taking an ice pick and putting a hole in your gas tank and then let it dribble out of your gas tank, right? So once you have glucose in your body, you shouldn't waste it, right? That's an important energy molecule. All right, but here it is in the filtrate, and one possible fate is to end up in urine, being wasted, but we're going to see what happens to it. So this process of water moving out, salt moving out, glucose moving out of plasma due to pressure difference and these filtration slits, that's what we call glomerular filtration. All right, so that's just kind of a passive process that is produced by pressure changes. Right, so pressure in the glomerulus is high, pressure in the Bowman's capsule is low, and so fluid just gets forced right out, just like when you make coffee in the morning. And the filter paper selects what molecules move into the coffee based on what attribute of those molecules? Just by size, right? Just by size. So maybe you like to have really strong coffee, so would you use filter paper? You know, you might not. Maybe you use one of these French devices that is just a screen, okay? And so you get bigger particles. So filtration just works by size of the particles. Big particles stay in the blood, smaller particles leak out into the filtrate. All right, so mostly plasma proteins are excluded because they're too big, and also because these proteins are negatively charged, and the filtration slits are negatively charged as well. And what can you tell me about similarly charged particles? They repel each other. So that's one reason why proteins don't get into the filtrate. Unless there's damage to the nephron, then there's plenty of proteins in urine, right? So that would be an example of nephritis, for instance, when those filtration slits or the podocytes become damaged, they become very, very leaky. Some protein, especially albumin, normally enters the filtrate, but it is reabsorbed by endocytosis later on in the proximal convoluted tubule. So I'll show you where that happens in just a second. So defects in the slit diaphragm results in massive leakage of protein in the filtrate, into the filtrate, and thus it appears in the urine, and we call that proteinuria when that happens, right? So that's an abnormal condition. Here's a beautiful scanning electron micrograph of a glomerulus. Okay, that's still covered with its visceral glomerular capsule. Here you can see those podocytes and the nice branches coming off the podocytes, the pedicels with the filtration slits, but fluid can move right through these spaces very, very easily. And then here's just another micrograph that shows the capillary. Right, here's a little fenestration in the capillary, the basement membrane, and the spaces between the foot processes. So fluid can move through this from plasma into the filtrate very, very easily. Okay. So let's talk about formation of the filtrate inside the glomerulus. So here is the afferent arteriole coming in. Here is the efferent arteriole taking blood out. And here we have a number of colored little particles. Okay. And plasma proteins, green. These are large. All right, so you can see that they don't get filtered out because they're too large to get through the filtration slits. The smaller particles, shown purple, enter the glomerular filtrate. So what kinds of particles might these little purple guys be? Salt, like sodium, chloride, potassium, calcium, even small molecules like glucose that you don't necessarily want to lose, right, as well as water. Water is very small. So all of that ends up in the filtrate. Okay, so, all right, so name the process by which these small plasma solutes, as well as water itself, enter the glomerular filtrate. What process? You know what? Yeah, diffusion, but that's really not fast enough. It's really due to a pressure difference, due to a hydrostatic pressure difference, just like when you make coffee in the morning, okay? So you have filter paper with coffee in it. Where do you put the water? On top of the filter or underneath the filter? On top, and then you just use gravity to pull the water through, right? Which, so there's a pressure difference across that filter paper that you have in there. So that's how glomerular filtration takes place.
Do healthy people excrete glucose?
No, we don't.
Never.
Never. Okay.
Diabetes, right?
Only in diabetes mellitus. We'll talk about that, why that happens. Okay, so here is that first process of urine formation, and that is glomerular filtration. And about 20% of the plasma that enters the nephron gets put into this glomerulus right here. So what do you think would happen to somebody if you were to lose 20% of your plasma volume? Well, you'd be in big trouble, right? Okay. Yeah, you'd become hypovolemic. All right, so the beauty of this system, though, is that as water moves across, it brings a lot of poisonous compounds with it, like urea. All right, so the way the kidney operates is that in order to get rid of a lot of toxic compounds, it throws almost everything out that's in the blood, including good things. All right, but in order not to be damaged by that kind of process, what happens to the good things that are in the filtrate at this point? They have to be reabsorbed, and that's the second process that we're interested in. It is called tubular reabsorption, and that's the function of the rest of the nephron. All right, so glomerular filtration rate is the volume of filtrate produced by both kidneys per minute, sort of like the cardiac output, except it's urine output, their filtrate output. It averages about 115 milliliters per minute in women. Oh, I didn't know there was such a big difference. 125 in men. All right, but here's the interesting thing. About 180 liters a day. You lose 180 liters of fluid a day by filtration. Right, that's 45 gallons. That's a huge amount. I think I calculated that if we were to lose that amount from our body, we would dehydrate in about 2.5 minutes. All right, so we have to recover that water. So most of the filtered water must be reabsorbed or death would result very, very quickly, okay, by just water loss due to urination. All right, so control of glomerular filtration rate is controlled by extrinsic and intrinsic mechanisms. So what does extrinsic mean to you? What's an extrinsic? It requires maybe nerves to control what's happening, something from outside the kidney or at least outside the nephron. Intrinsic is a mechanism that involves just the nephron itself, just the way that the nephron is put together, controls glomerular filtration. So that's, and intrinsic is another way of saying auto-regulation. The nephron can regulate itself. All right, and the way that it can do that is by vasoconstriction or dilation of the afferent arterioles. That affects the rate of blood flow through the glomerulus and thus the glomerular filtration rate. So if we reduce blood flow into the glomerulus, that reduces the filtration rate. All right, so let's look at extrinsic control first, and that is sympathetic stimulation. All right, so increased sympathetic nerve activity, and that might be due to exercise, for instance, or it might be due to a decrease in blood pressure that works through the baroreceptor reflex. Okay, do you believe me that decreased blood pressure can trigger this baroreceptor reflex? Do you have a little picture of what baroreceptor reflex is? Yeah. That increases sympathetic nerve activity, and you just might want to say increases sympathetic tone. I like using that term. Increases sympathetic tone. So what does that do? What's the effect on cardiac output? It goes up, right, because of the beta 1 receptors, right, on the heart. And increasing sympathetic tone causes vasoconstriction of the afferent arterioles in the kidney. So what happens then if the afferent arterioles vasoconstrict? What happens to blood flow through the glomerulus then? It goes way down because of Poiseuille's law, right? Poiseuille's equation. It goes down in a big way because radius is to the fourth power. So glomerular filtration goes down. That means that urine production goes down, which means that maintains blood volume or increases blood volume when the kidneys stop producing urine. Okay. Well, what else does sympathetic nerve activity do? Causes vasoconstriction in other blood vessels. Right, that increases total peripheral resistance. As total peripheral resistance goes up, what happens to blood pressure? It's directly related. Remember that? That's a good one to remember. Right, so blood pressure goes up. When blood volume goes up, venous return goes up. What happens to blood pressure then? It goes up, right? It goes up when blood volume goes up. Right, as venous return goes up and diastolic volume goes up, we call that the preload. That means cardiac output goes up, which means blood pressure goes up. Okay, so BP goes up. As cardiac output goes up, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up. And how does this effect relate to the initial stimulus?
It subtracts
from, and so this is a nice negative feedback loop. Okay, so this is, I put it in here, extrinsic mechanism. Right, that helps maintain blood pressure and shunts blood to the heart and other muscles during activity. All right, so the kidney is important that way for maintaining blood pressure. All right, let's talk about the autoregulation or intrinsic mechanisms. Okay, there are two different kinds, but autoregulation is defined as the ability to maintain relatively constant glomerular filtration rate in the face of fluctuating blood pressure. So blood pressure can go up, it can go down, but the nephron has the ability to maintain a certain rate of urine formation, irrespective of blood pressure. And the two ways are the myogenic response and tubuloglomerular response. The myogenic results from constriction of the afferent arteriole, smooth muscle, when there is a change in arterial blood pressure. So as somebody's blood pressure goes up, if there was no autoregulation, what would happen to blood flow into the glomerulus then? Okay, but if blood pressure goes up, what would happen to flow? It would increase.
Yeah.
All right, because remember, flow is equal to pressure divided by resistance. So if pressure goes up, flow would increase, and then urine output would increase. All right, but we don't want the kidney to increase urine formation whimsically as your blood pressure goes up and down. So it auto-regulates itself, so blood pressure can go up and down. And when it goes up, that causes constriction of the afferent arteriole. And so that maintains urine formation at the same rate. That keeps glomerular filtration at the same rate so that you don't dehydrate when your blood pressure goes up. Okay. Or if your blood pressure goes down, that means blood flow is going to be decreased, and so the arterioles dilate to maintain glomerular filtration. Right, so that's what we call autoregulation. The second way, that's achieved locally because there are certain chemicals that are produced very close to the afferent arterioles, namely the juxtaglomerular apparatus, that release chemicals All right, that caused vasodilation or vasoconstriction, and we call that tubuloglomerular feedback. That's just a little local control. We're going to look at the juxtaglomerular apparatus in just a little bit. Okay, so here's a pretty good table that shows what's going on. Okay, the regulation mechanism, sympathetic nerves. Sympathetic nerves are what? Are they intrinsic or extrinsic?
Extrinsic.
That's extrinsic. Okay, activated by the baroreceptor reflex or even by higher brain centers. That causes constriction. If the afferent arteriole constricts, what happens to GFR? That causes a decrease in pressure of the glomerulus, basically. And that means you don't have the same pressure causing filtration, so GFR decreases as a result. Okay. All right, now let's talk about autoregulation. What's another way that we could talk about autoregulation? That is, what kind of, that's an intrinsic mechanism, just a property of the nephron itself. All right, if there's a decrease in blood pressure that causes dilation of the afferent arteriole, all right, so if there's a decrease in blood pressure, there's going to be a tendency to decrease blood flow through the glomerulus, but if the afferent arteriole dilates, resistance goes down, so that maintains blood flow through the glomerulus, which maintains the glomerular filtration rate. And if on the other hand, if there's an increase in blood pressure, which is going to have a tendency to hyperperfuse the glomerulus, it's going to have a tendency to increase the glomerular filtration rate, produce way too much urine. What happens is that the arteriole constricts, that cuts back flow, and so then there is, again, no change in glomerular filtration rate when blood pressure fluctuates. Okay, so that's autoregulation. Okay, so I think I did talk about this already. An increase in, well, maybe not. Okay, there's a part of the distal convoluted tubule that, because it folds back and comes very close to the glomerulus, and it passes right between the afferent and efferent arteriole, and that's what we call the juxtaglomerular apparatus, and there is a part of it called the macula densa. And that's around the afferent arteriole. And as flow increases, as the flow of filtrate through the distal convoluted tubule increases, okay, that causes the signals to cause the macula densa to secrete a signal that constricts the afferent arteriole, which then reduces glomerular filtration rate, which then decreases that flow of filtrate through that region, bringing it back down to normal. All right, so tubuloglomerular feedback is just another intrinsic mechanism of the nephron itself. All right, so I think maybe I will start here next time, resorption of salt and water. And then we just have a few slides left. All right, now I did pass the sign-in sheet around. Where's that sign-in sheet at? And I didn't pass it out? No, I'm sure I did. I'm sure I did. Okay. You got it. Okay, so if you need it, it's coming down.